Hola, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Mark Russo. Today, we are discussing the upcoming Women's March with organizer Castina Charles.
Then, you'll want to pull out your calendar and save the date. The Underground Railroad History Project is having a fundraiser, and WOOC correspondent Brenda Miller spoke to co-founder Paul Stewart all about it.
After that, we'll visit with author Suzanne Spellin about one of the forgotten episodes in Capital Region history, with a look at industrialist Titus Eddy.
And finally, we'll speak with the infamous Trojan bookworm, Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books, about what books we should start off the year reading. Before we dig into any of that, we'll start the show off with some local headlines.
The Times Union reported that Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin added his campaign director, Richard Crist, to his assembly payroll last September in a part-time salaried position that paid the equivalent of about $67,000 a year. Crist, a longtime Republican political operative that had been fired from his job with the county after supporting McLaughlin in the primary, was also recently hired by the county to a job paying six figures. Crist filled timesheets indicating that he usually worked no more than 17 hours per week as an assembly staff person, the minimum required in a salaried position. Crist was hired to replace a woman who had accused McLaughlin of assaulting her.
The handling of Troy's garbage will be the first order of business for the new Democratic Party majority on the city council. The council will develop a plan to cut the city's garbage output and look to change from a flat annual fee of $160 per residential unit to one based on how much trash is generated, said Democratic Councilman Anasha Cummings. The city's goal will be to increase recycling and divert materials from the garbage stream, which will help reduce the amount of money the community pays for disposal. The council still work with Charles Wolchton, the city's first commissioner of general services, to develop a recycling program and trash plan.
Hundreds of people gathered Saturday at Troy Middle School to celebrate the lives of Shanta Myers and her young children, all victims of a brutal December 21st murder in Troy. Friends, clergy members, and community leaders reminded Myers' family's loved ones that they are not alone. Shanta Myers' eldest son, 15-year-old Isaiah Smith, said, "I just want to thank everybody for coming and gathering around."
The California State Teachers Retirement System and JANA Partners, who collectively won $2 billion worth of Apple stock, wrote an open letter to the company voicing their increasing concern about the effects of mobile devices and social media on youngsters. They urged Apple to offer more tools and choices to help prevent harm. The letter cited several studies revealing the negative effects of smartphones and social media on children's mental and physical health, including depression and inability to focus.
The Trump administration will end temporary legal immigration status for 200,000 Salvadorans who have been living in the U.S. for nearly two decades. They must return to their homeland by September 2019 or become undocumented immigrants without legal protections. Salvadorans were first granted protected status in 2001 after a pair of devastating earthquakes that killed nearly 1,000 people and destroyed more than 100,000 homes in the Central American country. Presidents Bush and Obama had extended the protections, ruling that the country had not fully recovered from the quakes and also had raging violence from drug cartels that made it impossible for so many people to return to the unstable nation.
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to dismiss the first legal challenge to a Republican-backed Mississippi law that permits businesses and government employees to refuse to serve lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people because of their religious beliefs. The court ruled that the various plaintiffs did not have standing to sue. Additional legal challenges, however, are expected. In India, the Supreme Court did agree to reconsider its 2013 ruling criminalizing gay sex.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC's Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. So I think it's interesting about, Chris and McLaughlin, about how, he's getting paid all this money when, Troy is always talking about or Rensselaer County is always talking about raising taxes, and it just seems like there should be a cap on how much government employees can get paid.
I totally agree with you, and probably have to turn in more than a timesheet to show that they're actually contributing to the communities that they're supposedly serving.
Right, right. I just think that that's interesting, and it seems, I don't know, I would really like to know the specifics on, like, what work he's doing that is worth six figures. That is interesting, and I feel like if it's, you know, if it has to be great, and if it's not great, why aren't we hearing about it? You know, it's interesting, for sure. But now we are joined by some guests. It's been almost a year since the Women's March in Washington, which brought millions of people to the streets to proclaim that women's rights are human rights, just one day after Donald Trump was inaugurated as president. This year, women are once again marching with us now, are two people organizing Albany's March, Christina Charles and Emily Marinchek. Thank you for joining us, guys.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit more about yourselves and how you found yourselves helping to organize this march last year?
Well, I am originally from New York. I came up here. Can you hear me? Can you hear me good?
Speak right on the mic.
Right. Okay. So I'm originally from New York City, moved up here about a decade ago, and I got in contact with Emily because she was organizing the tax march. And kind of a funny story, I was thinking about doing that myself. I was like, oh, I want to organize this. I was thinking about that. So I put in for the permit, but I found that it was already taken in the location. So I thought, who would be booking West Capitol Park on this day? Maybe I'm going to try to book something else. And then in that process, somebody found her on Facebook. It's like, oh, the march is already being organized. So I decided, you know what, since they got the better location, I am just going to reach out to her. And in that process, we started becoming friends and just talking and got together that way.
That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, and I started the march. I mean, I think the election last year of this administration really woke me up. I've been involved in politics at least peripherally. I've always voted. I've campaigned for people. But I've identified more as a mom and not necessarily a political activist. And then it just kind of short-circuited the state of affairs right now. And kind of all of a sudden, the next thing I knew, I was at a meeting. And then somebody said, somebody needs to get a permit. And the next thing I knew, I was like, wow, I guess I'm working on this. And when it came to the Women's March, Christina called me up and said, so I think we need to do something. And it didn't feel like a choice. It felt like we needed to do something.
Yeah. Were you both at the presidential or the march that took place around the presidential inauguration last year?
I was personally at the Women's March in Albany.
She was. I wasn't. And that's the funny thing for me and why this is a little bit more personal, because as Emily was saying, for me, I've always been very politically interested. I've always voted, but I never saw myself as an activist. I always felt like it's something private, like politics and religion. I'm not going to do that, right? I never talked about it. But I started off slowly. Like after the inauguration, I would do like signing petitions. And I went to my first meeting through moveon.org. And when the Women's March came, I thought, I don't know if I could do this. I felt kind of really shy. So I couldn't. And I think about a week after, I had my first meeting through moveon.org. And I went to my first rally. I was walking in the snow. It was in January 24th outside the federal building. And it's like, I'm going to do this. And when I went to that, and it was a small, like it wasn't a big, it was like 40, 50 people. There were some Trump people, they were pissed off. But I knew immediately, I can do this. I had that fear that I had went over me. The next week, I organized my first rally. And that's what started that process. So I organized my first rally after I went to my first one January 24th. So January 31st, I said, okay, I'm going to organize a rally. And I literally just started doing that like right after. Once I knew in myself that I can do this, like there's nothing to be afraid of.
That's amazing. I think oftentimes we feel like activists are these extraordinary people. And we don't always realize that they're really people like us that are just regular, you know, average citizens that feel passionate about issues and what's going on in their communities, and that it's just the only difference between you and them is that they have begun to feel empowered to do something And that's the only difference. And so I think that that's a really cool story, and I hope that that inspires other people listening to this to, you know, make that same transition that you made.
I think I've heard it said, like, and I don't even know where, but the only difference between an activist and a bystander is the ability to go to a meeting and the willingness to sit through meetings.
Yeah. It is. I would have to agree with that. I just want to add that with this current administration coming to power, it became extremely important to me as a mother, and I have people that I know, friends in other countries, that I thought I need to be counted here as somebody who is willing to go to a meeting now and to put my name on a list and to stand up and say something, because it's bleak, and I don't want history to show, oh, we were just sitting around not going to meetings and not standing up.
Right, certainly important. I agree. So lots of groups. So I guess we should also talk about, so you guys are having a march coming up, right?
Right.
So is there like a specific, I mean, obviously it's like women's issues, but just talk about the march that's coming up and how people can go and what to expect.
Okay, so the march is going to be on Saturday, January 20th from 1 to 3. It's divided into two portions. So there's the rally portion that's going to happen first, where you're going to have speakers. And then we're going to actually have the marching component afterwards. And it's open to anybody. I mean, even though it's the Women's March, I wanted to keep that name because I wanted to celebrate that history. And I know Emily and I were talking about the fact that this year is an unprecedented amount of women running for office, and winning seats. And so it's very important to celebrate that. But at the same time, for me, this is a call to action. This is something I want people to walk away doing something. And what you touched upon about that sense of anybody can do it, that's exactly what I want people to do. I want people to know, like, I can do this. Me, the mostly shy, quiet person, you know, although I can talk a lot if you give me the opportunity. But this shy, quiet person, if I can get up and say that I can do this, you can do it too. And if we do it together, then we can actually make real concrete changes in this program, so in this country. So I think that's the overall message. But obviously, we're going to be touching upon environmental issues, race issues, discrimination. We have some speakers coming in talking about what's going on with the migrant community in the Capital District area. So we're touching upon all those things. But the overall message that I want people to come away with is that you can do this and we can do this.
And women are doing this. And it's also important to just commemorate the historic magnitude of what happened last year with the Women's March, and to stand in solidarity that weekend of January 20th and also the 21st. There are marches all over the country. So if we're hoping people will come to Albany and join with us, but I'm also hoping people will just take to the street and stand up to fight back against what's going on.
Right. And so much of what you get from going to these rallies, too, is the networking, meeting people, which actually allows you to form those long-term connections to organize and accomplish that political change in your community. Like the groups you are a part of, Chris Cassino with the Altamont Main Street USA and Emily with Bethlehem New York Indivisible. What have you guys been up to with those groups?
Well, for me, I've been doing a lot of local organizing stuff. I did the rally, but I've also been focusing a lot on canvassing and networking. Like this aspect of meeting Emily, like that was intentional. Like when I decided to cancel the tax rally, I could have just like, well, you know, it's not going to happen. Somebody booked it and closed it. But I made the intent to meet her, to kind of reach out because I wanted to connect. So I've been spending the last year meeting with other small local activists, organizers, trying to kind of to do this. But I've also been doing a lot of canvassing, going in, which is another thing to get over, going door to door and knocking on people. And that's also taught me a lot too, the making that personal connection with people, because there's a lot of noise right now in terms of what's going on in the political landscape. There's a lot of stuff that you hear. But when you go to somebody's house and you meet people and you talk to them face to face, they see you and I see them. And that's a very powerful skill to have. So I've been focusing a lot on that.
So you guys talked about, you just touched on, you know, your connection with other activists and that, you know, creating like a stronger move of activists. But lots of groups are helping organize this march. What role do you think activist groups like the Altamont Main Street USA, Bethlehem New York Invisible, and many other groups that have come together recently are playing in the political landscape right now?
If I can just speak to Bethlehem Indivisible, for example, as just one group, people have been coming together and women are running for office, county legislature seats, town board seats, school board seats. People sort of woke up and said, oh, my goodness, not only did Trump win, but we've lost many seats and that no small part is too small to matter. And so we've seen Bethlehem Indivisible in particular doing a lot of local, getting people sort of grassroots involved and organized that way. Also, Christina and I have been trying to form coalitions between these groups. So I think there's definitely work with voter registration, getting people to the polls, getting candidate forums. We've been doing that a lot and trying to get people to meet their local neighbors who are running for office. And that's, I think, sort of the best part of the outcome of these groups forming.
And in terms of putting this event together, it kind of, and this kind of is a sort of testament to the power of the network and the power of women groups, because I first came up with this idea probably in the first week of December. I was at an event for fundraising for in Puerto Rico, and one of the people organized that, they were Progressives Connected, and I was talking. He said, oh, there's going to be Women's March. I was like, oh, great. And I'm thinking, you know, I just told you I didn't go to the first one, so I think I'm going to go. And then I found out, wait, there's nothing being organized in Albany. So I thought, okay, let me reach out to some of the women I've been talking to. And Emily was the first. And I said, if they say yes, we're going to try to move forward. And over the last couple of weeks, like, I went to another group, Capital Women, and they're a pack. Like, one of the co-founders is Libby Post, and they do a lot for raising money for candidates and all that type of stuff. And I spoke to them about why we should do this, and they said yes, and they sort of gave that support. And so a lot of the speakers, because I don't know, I don't have all of these particular connections, a lot of the speakers, many of the people that are co-sponsoring, they know them personally. And so they reached out. It's like, hey, can you get a band? Yes, I can get a band. Can you get this? So it's been that kind of collective effort. And we have bigger organizations that are part as well, like Sarah Coach. She's part of the 1199 SEIU. She's been great. They're working on getting sounds. They're helping with the marching. So it's definitely a very collaborative effort, but it feels like organic, and it's just, we're all kind of inspired by the same thing to kind of fight for our democracy.
So we only got like a minute left. And so if real quick, you could tell me one, who or what issues are most important that affecting women the most right now? And, you know, maybe a little bit about what you guys want to do about it. And then two, just recap where the event's going to be, when it's going to be, how you can be there, exactly. You know, you get it.
Want me to go first?
Okay. Okay, so the issues that are affecting women right now is that we're dependent on democracy for our life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. And I feel like that's really under attack. And so to just try and be succinct about it, I think this is to try and this rally is to try and energize people that there's no single one issue. It is economic, it's racial, it's environmental, and it all is about the politics of it, that we need to restore a sense of that you can elect fair people and that it's not corporate money that is just kind of ruling everything. The rally is January 20th at Capitol West Park, right at the New York State Capitol and State Street. It starts at 1 o'clock.
Thank you guys for joining us. We really, really appreciate it. That was Emily Marinchek and Christina Charles, two organizers of this year's Albany Women's March. You can make your voice heard alongside Christina and Emily. Like she just said, this Saturday, January 20th at the West Capitol Park on State Street in downtown Albany. And don't forget the rallies from 1 to 3. So next on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we have Susan Spellin. She's been many things, a writer, historian, preservationist, musician, traveler, designer, seamstress, teacher, and tour guide. A longtime Brooklynite and now a proud resident of Troy, New York. She runs spellingoftroy.com, a popular website about local history and architecture. We're really, really excited to have Suzanne on tonight. But unfortunately, she hasn't made it here yet, so we're going to move on to our next segment, which is WOOC Talk to the Underground Railroad History Project co-founder, Paul Stewart. He told us about his, or I should say, their upcoming fundraiser.
Paul is a community hero who, for the past two decades,
make me blush on the radio,
has been the leader of the Underground Railroad History Project, which is just so critical to our region. I'm wondering if you could just give us a little overview of the Underground Railroad History Project before we find out why you're really here.
Yeah. Well, one of the, I think it's good to start off by explaining that the project itself was originally a study project that my wife and I, Mary Liz, my wife and I, decided to do together to learn more about the story of the Underground Railroad. And as we began to look at it, we found people would tell us, oh, it's this, oh, it's that. And one of the things that happened for us is that very frequently what people said, oh, it's this, oh, it's that, and we find things that contradicted what they were saying. So we kind of got into it as a more of a long-term thing for her so that she could take more back into the classroom as a teacher and myself, because I was doing a lot of community, community work, working, both in my employment, but also on the side, working for community newspapers and things like that. So I wanted to write stories about these things that happened in the Tri-Cities area. And so as we made it a long-term project, we suddenly began to discover things that we weren't hearing from other people. And so that's kind of like how it was born. So the Underground Railroad History Project is a nonprofit organization. It's organized as a historical society. It's got a board of directors. We try to rediscover the story of the Underground Railroad as it relates to the Capital Region and tell that story. And we've also found lots of different ways of making that story more real or more tangible for us in the present day.
That's wonderful. And just what are some of the key projects at the Underground Railroad? Just to give us a little overview
sure.
of some of the key projects and the vision of the Underground
sure.
Railroad.
In terms of talking about how we made it tangible in the present day, I mean, we do things like we have a young abolitionist club of teens that meet throughout the year. We have what we call the Young Abolitionist Teen Scholars Institute, which is a space during the summertime when we utilize the summer youth employment program, and we have opportunities for young people to sit down and make some plans, to work with some facilitators, to make some plans about what they want to accomplish during that space. And they're actually come and they get paid to, do those projects. We're also involved in a restoration of an Underground Railroad site we call the Stephen and Harriet Myers Residence, which is in Albany. We also have a garden, which we call the Abram Johnson Garden, named after one of the Underground Railroad figures from that period. All of these, our annual conference, we do a lot of workshops and talks throughout the year. So all of these are ways in which we kind of bring the story to the community. But also it's linked with some research, because we also do research around the stories and links with things that are tied into our community. Also, we do archaeology, which we've had some really wonderful experiences with archaeology. We had a great group from the State University that came down this past summer, did a really what was for us a major archaeological dig in the backyard. They discovered, the water cistern, a lot of pieces that were unbroken in the bottom of the water cistern, pottery and plates and things. So amazing stuff that helps us fill out the story in terms of talking about, what was the daily life of the folks that were here in the Capital Region and living in that period. So those are some of the things that we do project-wise.
And I'm sure that being sustainable as a nonprofit is a big challenge, and that leads us into Dining with Stevie.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if you could tell us about your program, Dining with Stevie.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is a challenge for all nonprofit organizations, of course, is this idea of sustainability, being able to have the funds to keep the lights on and, you know, do all the programming that you do, et cetera. And so one of the things that we've been doing is this thing we call Dining with Stevie. One of our board members helped put this together, and we've selected a bunch of different restaurants. So we've had it at TCBY, yogurt at Five Guys, at Panera. And as a matter of fact, this one coming up on January 9th is going to be at Panera at Crossgates Commons. So that's at 161 Washington Avenue Extension. Most people will recognize that as Crossgates Commons. And so it's on Tuesday, January 9th from 4 to 8 p.m. And what happens is that people can they go to our website, undergroundrailroadhistory.org, look on the calendar, they'll see a flyer that has the Dining with Stevie and the Panera bread and everything. What they would do is they would take that flyer. They can even take it like on their phone or, you know, and show that when they go in to place their order and when they go to pay for their food. And then the Underground Railroad History Project will get some money back from them just going and eating. And that's the really cool thing. They don't have to do anything complex or anything. They just have to go out and eat.
Well, all we have to do is eat to support the Underground Railroad History Project.
Yeah, isn't that great?
That's fantastic. Just before we let you go, I mean, I feel like I want to invite you to come back again, because it's almost impossible to tell the incredible stories. There's so many you have brought to life. I'm just wondering, how do you tell a story? What are a few of the stories that you have unearthed and that you have shared?
Well, there are lots of individual stories, and we have the good fortune for a lot of this stuff kind of comes together and in interesting ways. There was a flyer that was a key document in helping us get the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence on the National Register of Historic Places. That document talks about a 10-month period during which there are 200 and some people who were referred to Albany and came through the Albany Schenectady Troy connection with the Underground Railroad here. And the there was a book that came out not too long ago from Eric Foner, who was a professor at Columbia University, and he looked at that document. He looked at another document that was out of New York City that was about some 250 people across a different period of time, but it was overlapping. And we found that the 50 of the people that were identified in the document that he was using overlapped into the period that was relevant for the Stephen and Harriet Myers residence. So we actually, because of that, we know the names and the approximate dates that 50 people who were referred to the Capital Region from New York City. And that's something that's really, really just, you know, knocking it out of the park. You know, it's a lot of times you'll hear about these different folks and people talk about an Underground Railroad site and sort of like it's all vague and you don't know who was there and, you know, these people, you know. And so here's a space where we can put names and dates on when these folks were there and to a certain degree trace their stories, which is much more than can be done in a lot of Underground Railroad stories that people talk about.
That's really amazing.
Yeah,
and the young abolitionists today, as they walk through the Stephen Myers Museum, can be standing in the footsteps, and that brings the living history
to these
stories.
Really exciting. You know, the front parlor and this flyer that I talked about. The flyer talks about an abolitionist meeting, an Underground Railroad meeting, and you know, when you put two and two together, you know, that meeting would have taken place in the front parlor of what's called the Stephen and Harriet Myers Residence Building. So it's kind of a cool space in the sense of being in a place where some decisions were made and where some folks no doubt were interviewed to find out what their needs were in connection with the Underground Railroad, that both, you know, both wrapping in both the secret and the public side of the story. And that's another thing. You know, we always talk about the secrecy of the Underground Railroad, but then you've got, everybody knows that, this is like the elephant in the room. Everybody knows that Frederick Douglass published the newspaper. It was called Frederick Douglass's Paper. And there were reports in the paper about all the meetings and things that people were doing and the others. So, and it's not only just his newspaper. There were many, many other newspapers, you know, in this, both in this region and across the state, and they all told a lot about a lot of this kind of stuff. So there was much more openness than I think we like to think about the secrecy. We like to think things are kind of being kept from us. But
well, and that really leads into the challenge of how we can go beyond just telling these stories and actually pull out. Lessons for
sure. There are lessons for us in the day. Yeah, right. Absolutely. You know, the Underground Railroad story is not just the narrow story of people escaping from enslavement and making their way to here or Canada or wherever, but it's a broader story. It's an international story, not only in developing Canada, but also there are many other aspects of the story that when you really look at it hard, you know, the Seminole Wars, the secession of Texas. Many other things that are really tied into the Underground Railroad story that we typically don't teach that way, you know. And of course, you know, the roots of slavery linking into, you know, Jim Crow and then mass incarceration. Again, these are elements of the story that we usually don't teach in that way, but they're there, and that's how we like to unfold the story. So that people can kind of see the connectedness. And then there are things like I was mentioning a while back, this when Elizabeth Warren was bringing up some issues with Senator Sessions when he was being identified as a person to be the head of the Justice Department. And she was prevented from speaking because of this rule that actually had its roots in the 1830s when senators were criticizing each other over the issues of enslavement. And so they came up with this rule that senators couldn't criticize each other. So, I mean, that's just one of the many little pieces that, you know, tie past and present together.
Thank you so much for keeping the struggle against injustice alive through this living history. And again, let's just remind people about Dining with Stevie.
Yeah, Dining with Stevie on the 9th of January and from 4 to 8 p.m. And you can get the coupon. It is on our website, undergroundrailroadhistory.org, or on our Facebook page, Underground Railroad History Project. And they, you know, get that coupon and show that coupon when you order your food and when you pay for your food, and Underground Railroad History Project will get a share of that.
We are now finally joined by Suzanne Spellman. But if you're just tuning in, that was, I don't know.
That was Underground Railroad History Project co-founder Paul Stewart speaking with WOOC correspondent Brenda Miller about their fundraiser. Now we are joined by Suzanne.
Yes. She's been many things, a writer, historian, preservationist, musician, traveler, designer, seamstress, teacher, and tour guide, a longtime Brooklynite, and now a proud resident of Troy. She runs spellinoftroy.com, a popular website it's about local history and architecture. Welcome to the show, Suzanne.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
God, that was a rough start.
Well, we'll carry it on home. So, Suzanne, now that you're here, and we're glad to have you here, I'm especially glad to have a fellow New York City to Troy transplant in the room. I have plenty of reasons myself that I know and love Troy and a whole story of what brought me here, but I'm not the one who's here to be interviewed. So I'm really curious to hear your journey to Troy and what brought you here.
Well, what brought me here was the Depression of 2008. I was living in Brooklyn. I had bought a house in Crown Heights. And I had two tenants and a job, and all was well. And then all of a sudden, I didn't have a job, and one of my tenants didn't have a job, and I eventually lost the house to foreclosure. So I had to go somewhere else. I couldn't afford to live anywhere in New York. And I started trolling realtor.com and decided that I wanted to stay in New York. I grew up upstate. I looked around where I grew up, which was the Oneonta, Otsego County area, and it was too expensive up there. And so just started looking in different cities. And found a listing for this wonderful rectory building that was for sale in Troy. So I borrowed a friend's car. My friend and I drove up here. We took one look at Troy and said, okay, if we don't get this building, we're going to get something because this is a cool place. And we did not get the rectory building, but we did find a great two-family house. And my friend, who was my tenant in Brooklyn, and I ended up moving up here, and she has one apartment and I have another, and we love it.
That's amazing. Beautiful. I love hearing about people finding happiness in strange times. So tell us about your blog, spellandoftroy.com.
Well, I was working for a blog called Brownstoner in Brooklyn, and he started out writing about his renovation of his brownstone. And eventually, when he got to a certain point, he actually went outside and was looking at his neighborhood, and he started riding his bike around and looking at different neighborhoods. And when he got to my neighborhood and Bed-Stuy and Crown Heights, he was like, this is great. There are all these wonderful buildings. And he was putting them on his blog, but he didn't know anything about them. So I happened to be a longtime history and architecture buff, and I knew things about the buildings that he was posting. So I started writing in the comment section, oh, that's the such and such a building, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was this, it was that, and now it's this. And after a while, he just said, you want to write a column? And that was around the same time that I lost my job, so I had plenty of time. And so I started writing a column for him, and it got really popular, and it became two columns. And in a space of about a year and a half, I was writing 9 columns a week for him for it was like 2 a day, and then one day there was only 1. So it was a lot of work, and it was all research and writing. And that's not my background. That's not what I was doing before.
What were you doing before?
I was actually the designer and production manager for a company that made luxury bedding. So, as a production manager.
That's quite a change.
Yeah, and but I was always a good writer. And even for the companies I worked for, I would end up writing ad copy, and I was always writing letters for my bosses. And it was just something I was always good at. So when I started to write these columns, the first ones were, you know, they were okay, but I got better and better and better. And was able to research more. I was really lucky. The internet was expanding, and more information was available on the internet to find out about all these buildings. And I got quite a following. I even got a lot of professionals in the New York City Preservation Department, professors at Columbia, you know, a lot of big people in Christopher Gray, who wrote a streetscapes column for the New York Times. All these people became fans who were commenting on my articles. And I was hot stuff for a while there.
Wow, that's really, really impressive. So I saw that you also write under the name Montrose Morris.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, Montrose Morris was a 19th century architect, male architect, who designed a lot of his buildings in both Crown Heights and Bedford-Stuyvesant. And when I was looking for a handle on the blog, because very few people use their real names, I just picked him because I liked his work, and he transcended both neighborhoods. And so I started writing as Montrose Morris and became known as MM to everybody on the blog. And got to the point where I was doing so much work that I had to finally decide to write under my own name, because people were hiring me to do things and they were Googling my name and there was nothing there. So I decided I better come out from under Montrose Morris and become Suzanne Spellin.
So is that the point where you were able to to generate a full-time living from blogging? Have you been able to do that?
No, it was a living, but it wasn't much of a living. Blogging does not pay well, especially if you don't own the blog. Brownstoner itself was doing really well. The owner was making a nice living from advertising and a lot of real estate stuff. And I was making enough to barely survive, but I was also working for private clients. I would write house histories. And I was also doing a lot of freelance work in anything else I could find, especially on the sewing and design end. So between the two of them, I managed to, squeeze out a meager living.
So in terms of, a lot of people have been talking about gentrification, development. A lot of people are coming from the areas in Brooklyn that you left and moving to Troy. Do you see a lot of similar trends here?
As far as what's here now and what's happening here now?
Yeah.
I think a little bit. Brooklyn was such a phenomenon of hyper-gentrification in a really short period of time. I don't think any other city could have done that, thank goodness. And I think Troy is doing rapid changing, and most of it is great. I think the renaissance of downtown is wonderful. And it's sort of funny that half of Brooklyn seems to be moving up here to buy buildings and renovate them and start businesses. I'm hoping that because Troy has so much more physical room to grow, that the pace of gentrification will not overtake good sense. I would hate to see hordes of people coming up here and snatching up everything and forcing people out. I didn't like it when it happened to me in Brooklyn. I didn't like it. I just don't like it. I don't think that's the kind of growth that we need. We need to have a combination of everyone, from the lowest to the highest. I don't think you can be all low income, but you can't be all rich. You have to have a mixture of everyone for a vital city.
I completely agree. But since you mentioned rich people, your most recent blog post is about the 19th century millionaire industrialist Titus Eddy. Can you talk a little bit about him and his home?
Sure. Like I said, when I moved up here, I fell in love with the architecture. And I just love, wherever I am, walking around and looking around and looking at buildings. And I live here in North Central. And one day I was on Glen Avenue, and I just happened to look up, and it was in the fall, and the leaves were gone, and there was this mansion sitting up on the side of the hill, and I was like, what is that? And I asked people, my neighbors and people I ran into, I said, what is that building up there on the hill? And nobody knew what it was, which was kind of awful, and it's in the education of Trojans, but... and finally, I found out that it was now the administration building for the Troy Housing Authority, and that it had belonged to a guy named Titus Eddy. So I did some research and found out who Titus Eddy was, and decided to write about it. Went up there, they had a tour last autumn. I was able to take some pictures inside and some great shots outside, and decided to write about him.
Can you tell us who Titus Eddy is?
Well, Titus Eddy was an ink maker, and he invented a secret formula for ink that was so good, and so he made this wonderful black ink that was indelible, and it was so good that the Bureau of Engraving and Printing in Washington used it for money. So he was the supplier of all of the ink that printed the money between 1861 and 1908. And he also did some other colors for some other kinds of currency and bonds and things like that. So as you can imagine, as the only guy who had the secret formula to make ink, he got stinking rich. And, he had this wonderful secret.
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting. Someone else kind of pointed this out to me, that it's a little interesting how, this building that is, has this history about, a guy being really, really rich and specifically making money from making money, I guess, actually. And it's now the Housing Authority building. You know, it's there's a little bit of irony there.
There is. I'm sure he's rolling, spinning in his grave. But in the interim, after his family was no longer living there, it went to Russell Sage College. And Russell Sage was using it as an athletic facility. They had horse stables and all kinds of athletic fields and whatnot up there before the Martin Luther King houses were built. And they used it for a number of years. And then they got rid of it, and the city of Troy owned it, and they put the Housing Authority there.
That's a pretty great story. I'm looking forward to reading a lot more on your blog. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
That was Troy writer and historian Suzanne Spellin. You can find her blog at spellinoftroy.com. Now, for those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn about how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
We are now joined by Stanley Hatzel from Troy's Market Block Books. Every week, Stanley brings us a list of must-reads. And this is the first time we've seen Stanley this year, 2018.
Yes, it is.
Happy New Year, Stanley.
Happy New Year.
Glad to have you.
Thanks.
So what kind of goodie reads do you have for us this week?
I'm going to start with the children's books that I have here. And the first one is actually called Martin's Dream Day. And this is a picture book based on Martin Luther King's speech, the I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. Beautiful. And look at just the back cover, too, has a big quote from the...
says, I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold those truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Definitely speaks to his core message.
Yeah. And with that, oops, wrong book. I have this, What's the Big Deal About Freedom? And this is as part of a Black History Month, but also Martin Luther King Day. It talks about different aspects of freedom that are things that are guaranteed by our Constitution that may or may not be available to all people in this country. So that's another kid's book, great illustrations, and a really good historical representation of the founding of our country. And
I really like the pictures. The pictures are, they're not at all in the same style in terms of the quality of them, but they kind of remind me of the Schoolhouse videos and seem to be presenting these really complex ideas in a very accessible way.
Yes, exactly. Well said. Thank you, Mark. I'm glad you're here.
I wrote a lot of book reports in my day.
The third book is sort of a transition book. It's a children's book of poems. It's called Breathe and Be, and it's a book of mindfulness poems. So it's teaching mindfulness to children and also adults, because this is really a shared book. It's gorgeously illustrated.
It is gorgeous.
And fun to read, and there's practice aspects of it, ways to be still, practice your breathing, be aware of the sound around you. It's
they're very useful skills for adults, or poems can and give you access to the skills for that are really useful for adults. But right. If you can teach children these skills earlier on, then you can be a more level-headed grown-up when you grow up.
Exactly. And my buddy, Thich Nhat Hanh, he always encourages teaching meditation to children. So,
how old or what's the youngest you think this book could be for?
I think you could probably start with three.
Three?
Yeah, I really do.
Yeah.
I mean, there aren't big words in
here's
anything,
one.
But.
Here's, there's a quiet place in my head like an egg hidden in a nest. A place I go when the world is loud. A moss-green forest with birds.
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Keep this guy. He's terrific.
Thanks. I'll be back on Monday, probably.
Excellent. I'll be listening. So along with this transition, I'm kind of like leading into some New Year's books. So this next one is a daily Stoic journal. Stoicism was a philosophical practice that began like around 300 BCE. And then
Seneca,
pardon me?
Seneca.
Seneca and, I don't know how to say it, Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius was connected. It's a kind of a Hellenic and Roman philosophy. It went as late as 300 Common Era. And so it talks about being more logical, trying to slow down, don't be impulsive. This is actually written as a diary, but it's juxtaposed with lots of text and ideas for reflection.
Yeah, it says things like, why get angry at things if anger doesn't change it?
Yeah.
I feel like it's, I've been reading some things that many of the founding fathers were also into Stoicism as a, like, Enlightenment philosophy.
I think whenever people say, like, you know, I want to reflect, I think it can be hard to learn how to reflect properly and mm-hmm. effectively if you've never done it before. And this book certainly seems like a very, you know, straightforward way of doing that.
Right.
Few pictures, though, if you like pictures.
No, no pictures.
No pictures.
However, I do have this tiny book, and I know you like tiny books, Tatiana, Ethics of the Art of Character. And this is sort of a scaled-down version on topics that are related to ethics. And every other page is a different topic. This is a series that this company puts out. They're beautifully done. The covers are lovely. There's architectural books, art books, and this one happens to be ethics. And it goes nicely with the beginning of the year, kind of looking at how you look at the world.
I don't want to be crude, but this looks like phenomenal bathroom reading material. Everything is like a couple pages. It's perfect. And there's pictures.
Oh my gosh, you and the pictures.
Yeah, they're really, they're like a block, not block prints. What do you call that?
This has some broad, this has things that look like almost like New Yorker cartoons. There's some like wood cut or there's some really beautiful old, like what seem like really old paintings or things of classical drawings illustrating different castles of virtue or all kinds of stuff. But then there's also some, yeah, like I said, more contemporary looking things.
Yeah. I always get happy when I see that publisher's books come in the store, because they're usually gorgeously done.
Bloomsbury.
Yes. So now to the heart of the issue, which is what do you do for your New Year's resolution? If you do New Year's resolutions, I personally, if I do them, I don't tell anybody. That way, if I fail, no one knows. But the other part is,
that's a great accountability strategy.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. But the other is that every day can be my new year. So I don't feel like I want to be constrained by the calendar that says I have to, on January 1st, I have to alter my behavior yet again.
Yeah, because time isn't real. So
yeah, exactly. Time is artificial. That's my.
It's all relative, man.
And artificial. So here's your first book. It's called Fidget.
101 ways to boost your creativity and decrease your stress.
So it's proven that certain types of fidgeting actually can help you calm yourself so you can stay focused. Like people click pens or chew gum. And those are strategies for coping for people. And so this book is all about that being an avenue toward getting to a level of creativity.
So the question on everybody's mind is, are fidget spinners included in the fidget book? They are?
Fidget spinners help a lot of kids to calm down and stay focused.
I like this bounce on an exercise ball thing. There's bounce on exercise balls in there. I feel like I could do that at work and work on my core.
Yeah.
While I'm typing things.
And the next one is called Everything in Its Place. And this is an organizational strategy based on what chefs know called mise en place, that everything has its place and station. So it's about learning how to be organized. And if you're not good at that, this is a way to kind of get you into it. It's probably going to take a little time to get used to that sense of structuring. Like, it's not about kitchens and food, it's about your whole life. So that's
interesting.
I'm super into this. I'm sorry
to interrupt. No, okay. But
I love cooking, and I love and I'm not very well organized, so this book is like, ooh. I wonder.
I think there are so many organizational books out there that it gets really overwhelming to figure out like which ones actually help you and which ones
and honestly I really tried to pick four books that I thought made more sense to me and how I would do it. So the next book is a weight loss book. It's called A Little Book of Big Weight Loss, 31 Rules to Live By. And this woman has connections with people who are always in the public eye, performers, actors, etc. And she does some really practical things about the way you eat. And she doesn't encourage dieting at all. It's like how you start your day, what you eat. And she avoids all sugar, including fructose. She doesn't drink carbonated beverages. And she has this whole list. And it's also graphically a beautifully done book. It's not complex. There's not a lot of rules. It is super simple.
And it's just like number. It's like I drink green tea over other tea. I eat whole foods. I try to get 9 hours of sleep. You know, it's like very to the point, not complicated.
And they're logical.
I finish eating at 7 p.m. and don't eat again until 10 a.m. 10 a.m. is a little late for me. But
well, what she does is she has coffee in the morning to kind of boost her metabolism to how she starts it. And so that when that kicks in, then at 10 is when she's able to have a meal or breakfast.
Interesting.
It's a fascinating concept. I hadn't thought about that.
There's so much of wellness altogether comes through routine and establishing like positive patterns. It's nice if there's, you know, there's all these different rules that might be a little bit overwhelming to try and do all these different things, but you could do three of them and start them in a week and then next week add another one. And then over the course of time, you can build up into a really positive routine for whatever you want to do. If it's trying to lose weight or maintain your weight or maintain a healthy diet, all kinds of stuff.
The last in the self-helpy things is called Home Chic. And again, this is one of these practical things on how to improve your house, whether you have a tiny house or space, a tiny living space, low ceilings, ridiculous corners and angles you can't. And she comes up with some really clever ideas with great photos on how to tweak what you're frustrated with in your life.
I love it. I am always trying to up my apartment without trying not to spend a lot of money on weird things. And it looks like a lot of this stuff is not like things you have to buy brand new. A lot of it is...
Yeah, this is like Free Cycle Central here.
Exactly. I love that. It's also much more environmentally friendly to do that.
Yes.
So this book is for me.
Yeah, this is for me too. This is not high-end. This is practical. Again, all these that I'm trying to show you are really practical books.
This is crazy. This is like maybe the first time in a very long time that we've gone through all the books. Oh, wait, do you have one more book?
More.
Okay, we can fit it in. We're good.
And
we're
this is called I'm Dead, Now What? And this is a practical book about the important information about your life and your belongings that the people need to know after you're gone. And we don't really have anything like this. Everything from your passwords to your accounts to who... It's a way also of passing your life story on. There's places about talking about who your parents are, how you grew up, and you can share that with your family, your children, your grandchildren. But it's meant to be really practical as well. Everything you can imagine is in this book. And, I mean, it's something that we don't do. You know, we don't have an advanced directive. So what's going to happen if you're unconscious and no one knows what you really wanted because you never wrote it down?
Right. And I think it's just the topic that's so uncomfortable. And
it has to stop being uncomfortable.
I mean, definitely.
We are messed up on issues like death and sex and nudity. It's like we have to get over these things and start dealing with life. And this is – death is part of life. And we just have to embrace it as part of the process.
This is great because also I think that's one of the things people always put off at the last minute just put off until never practically. And so the fact that there is like a really concrete, cool journal that you can really put all these things in one place, that's amazing. And yeah. I don't know, I feel like I should have thought of that.
It's very straightforward. It seems pretty I'm just flipping through it, but it seems very comprehensive. And it's very accessible, which I think is a lot of what we have, like, phobia with dealing with death and these other things. Right. It's like, where do you even start? It's like, well, just open and start on the first page.
And it's not a bunch of legal documents, which is what always intimidates me when you look at your, you know, advanced directive or health proxy, whatever you fill in. It's like, that makes you clench up. It's like, this is, and we've just had two of our lovely neighbors pass away this past week, so this kind of reminds me that this has to be brought up yet again.
The winter is a time that often, even if it's not happening immediately, what people think of it. It's pretty reasonably priced, too. It says the suggested price is only...
Oh. Cheap.
It's under $20. Excuse me.
And what's the book called again?
It's called I'm Dead, Now What?
Awesome. Well, now we are actually out of time. So let's see. Let's move on to the end of our show. But thank you for joining us once again, Stanley.
You are so welcome. It's my pleasure.
Well, if you heard the last of that was Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books. He comes with us every week to give us the lowdown on some good books to read.
That concludes our show. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose through your Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and our Facebook page.
As a reminder, WOOC 105.3 is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in joining in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings held on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.